Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back to the Total Education Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net. For more information, Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, again, in the Beach Lifestyle Celebrity segment. And I'm really excited to welcome the program, I guess, Baywatch and much, much more celebrity, David Chokichi. David, thanks for calling, man.
You bet, dude, and you got it right. Chokichi. Not many people do that.
Hey, I have to pronunciate a ton. I wonder how many interviews I've ever done, but I do about 20 a week, so I'm becoming, a professional, so-called, but it's really easy for me to do this stuff, and you wouldn't believe some of the pronunciations I have to deal with, David. They're crazy, man. But I when I heard I was going to get to interview you, David, I looked at your IMBD, and I saw your picture, and I said, I recognized you absolutely from Baywatch. That's where I know you from, and specifically, and do lots of people recognize you still remembering you from Baywatch, in your opinion?
Oh, yeah. It's 18 years later, and I get it. It's crazy. I get it all the time. It's unbelievable. Luckily, I've stayed fit and healthy, and I've aged pretty well, so I kind of somewhat still look like my character, Cody Madison, and it's hilarious. I could be anywhere. I've been all over the world, either on the adventure or we're shooting a movie or and in the most random places in the world, and people will be like, holy, you're Cody Madison. Like, it's crazy. Like, we were clearing customs one time in Chile in this little tiny small fishing village. And the guy, it's a real full-on, TSA, customs, blah, blah. And he's looking at my passport, and he's like, hey, you're Cody, huh? Cody, Baywatch. And then he's like, hey, can I come outside of the booth and take pictures with you? And he's like, he's totally, breaking protocol. Like, he's out on the bulletproof casing, and we're taking photos and stuff, so. I mean, the show is legendary, We're in the Guinness Book of World Records, and it still is alive and well, and, I get it quite a bit still. It's, even though I've gone on to, continue to work.
Oh, my gosh, absolutely, a lot of work. Yeah, and we're going to talk about that, especially with the projects, David. But, I mean, that's what I recognized you. And, honestly, I was not a Baywatch fan. I probably watched it once or twice, maybe for the chicks. But, ultimately, it's just your face is just so recognizable, for sure.
Yeah. I've done a fair amount of things. I also, I host a show for Spike TV, and I do a lot with the environment and stuff. So I'm kind of, I'm out there, I guess. You got to be, and one of the coolest things about obviously being an actor is you have a voice and you get to help, people or the environment. And I try and be as proactive as possible. And then, and working with Surf Rider Foundation and Waterkeeper Alliance and things like that, and Best Friends of Animal Society, the ocean and the animals are my thing. So those are my kind of focus charities. But
gotcha.
And, having a voice, and people, they don't have to listen, but you get to kind of send a message, and a lot of times it improves the world.
Absolutely. Let's go right, David, specifically to, again, being part of the Cape Cod Bay Challenge. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, that started, I'm from Plymouth, Massachusetts, and that started 6 years ago. Myself and seven other guys decided randomly to see if we could paddle from Plymouth across Cape Cod Bay to Provincetown on Santaford. So we met at 4:30 in the morning. I was on a 10-foot board. We were kind of all ill prepared. We didn't have enough of everything. We had one support boat. But we did it. We had great conditions that day, luckily. And it's grown from 8 paddlers to last year we had 85 paddlers, I believe. And this year there was some attrition because the conditions last year were really hard. So we had 57 paddlers, but we've raised over $120,000 for Christopher's Haven, which is this amazing charity in Boston. Are you familiar with it?
No, we definitely are. Our audience wants to know more about that. So basically, this challenge raises money for Christopher Haven's benefit. So tell us a little bit about that.
Families come from around the world to Mass General and the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute for children's cancer, and the majority of these families are impoverished, and you know they have no place to stay while their child is in treatment, and they can be there a week, a month, 6 months, a year, who knows? And basically, Christopher's Haven provides housing for the families while their son or daughter is being treated.
Wow.
And, it's an unbelievable great charity. And, we've gone on to do some wonderful things together. And then, you know, each year the money is growing and the amount of people and the interest. And it all started kind of on a whim of just, you know, it was a challenge. Like, and then we attached a charity to it because we're like, why not? And, but it was just like, hey, do you think we could make this, you know, do you think we could make this distance and survive it? And sure enough, we did, and then it exploded. So, yeah, CapeCodBayChallenge.org, check it out. And every year it happens around mid-August. And, if you want to come out and see if you can paddle 34 miles on your stand-up board, we welcome you.
Wow. So that must be a lot of training involved before the event, isn't there?
There definitely is, and this year, because I'm in New York City, and I'm not too psyched about paddling on the Hudson, I didn't train as much. I mean, I did some simulated training. I swam, and I lifted weights, and I did all kinds of other things, but I wasn't on my board enough, and we had some bad conditions. We had to paddle at in the 12 to 15 knots for about 10 miles, which is, on a stand-up board, is about the most painful thing you can kind of do, because you're paddling on one side the whole time just to stay up wind, and so your things start cramping up, your triceps, your feet, your legs, everything, and you really can't stop to, like, I mean, we have camelbacks, and you can suck water, but once they run dry, if you stop to change out your camelback, you know, you're losing ground very fast, you know, you're blown backwards, so... It was a true mental battle, and I definitely paid the price. But I made it. I made it, man. A lot of people got yanked out of boats. You got to maintain maintain 4 knots or above in order to do it. And it takes us 11, this year took us 11 hours. And we have short breaks every 2 hours. We have like a 8-minute break to sit down, refuel, eat, drink, and just like stretch out, whatever, and get going.
So are any other celebrities involved in this event?
There's some pro stand-up paddlers. Celebrity-wise, not really. I think I'm the only one stupid enough to get out there and do it. You know what I mean?
You got to recruit them, man. Recruit them. Say you got to.
Yeah, I'm trying. My buddy Inger Rademacher, who was on General Hospital for years, he would do it, but he lives over in Hawaii, and he does the Molokai stand-up crossing, which is a brutal one. They pop up all over the place now, you know, these challenges, and they're great things and great fundraisers.
Okay. So again, you help out so much with the Christopher Haven's based being involved in the challenge and promoting it. And what a great cause, especially for families going through those, dealing with the grief. But then you also talked about the involvement in the environment. And I could tell you're the kind of guy when you talked about the importance of this. So tell me a little bit about the Surf Rider Foundation.
Sure. Yeah. You know, basically it's funny enough, like I was introduced to Surf Rider Foundation on Baywatch. We actually had an episode where there was a water quality testing issue. They wanted to ban water quality testing because of funding. And this was, you know, fucking 18 years ago, right? So, and that happened to be my storyline, myself and Gino Lee Nolan. And fast forward to literally last summer, Obama wants to cut water quality testing out of the budget. And, you know, water quality testing is like $2 million for the country. It's a joke. And he's thinking that's making hard cuts. And basically, you know, you're without the testing, you're sending your family, your kids into water, into oceans or rivers, and that are potentially very toxic or loaded with bacteria or sewage. And it may look pristine, it may look like Waikiki, but it's loaded with, you know, very harmful things. And so that was one thing. Like, literally, I went and testified with the certified lawyer. We went and testified on behalf of Surf Rider Foundation down to Congress, and basically had appealed to a bunch of senators and congressmen and to reinstate the funding. And, you know, it's still up for debate, I guess, you know. It's just kind of a strange thing. And ever since that introduction, whatever, when I started on Baywatch, that I've been heavily involved with them. And I was distinguished enough to receive the Keeper of the Coast Award, which is an award they only give out every 5 years to people who celebrities or musicians who go out of their way kind of unselfishly to give back to the ocean or the beaches or the waves or to educate people. And it was really prestigious and awesome. It was myself, it was Pearl Jam, and the band Incubus, and three of us basically received this award at this huge event that they pump a lot of money into. And and the fact that they only give it out every 5 years is remarkable, and to receive that was fantastic. And the other ones, I'm friends with Robert Kennedy Jr. and Waterkeeper Alliance is a big one I do a lot with, which is more river-based, but I try and help him as much as possible. It's like, I fly fish and I kayak, and you know, I just want to pass on clean natural resources to our kids. You know, we have a 2-year-old daughter, and I want her to be able to, like, know if she's going to go jump in the ocean that it's safe. She's not going to get sick. You know, I mean, in LA it's disgusting. If it rains, you know, all these websites pop up like don't go surfing, high bacteria levels, all these beaches, or guaranteed you'll get sick, and you know. Yeah, and you do. And you guaranteed you come home with a sickness, and that's just terrible. So I definitely do a lot with the ocean, and then also like Sea Surfers Environmental Alliance, which is one where we actually paddle around Manhattan. That's another stand-up paddle event that gives back to the oceans and also autism. And then I do some work with Gila Bay, and then the other big one is animals, and I got to squeeze that in there because we rescued our pit mix from this out in L.A. It's called Best Friends Animal Society, and they're based in Kanab, Utah, and they have hundreds of acres, and they have state-of-the-art facility, and they basically will take animals and let them live out their lives. Instead of euthanizing them, they will let them live out their lives in this beautiful country. You know, they actually took all 21, or I think it was 21 of Michael Vick's dogs, the pit bulls that were victimized, and they rehabbed every single one except one. And they were released back out to families and totally safe. And, you know, that's the kind of things they're doing. They're amazing, you know.
Absolutely.
It's a fantastic, unbelievable place.
You're doing so many awesome things to help people out. So, I mean, it's going to be interesting. I guess what we'll do is get the websites of all the ones you were going to promote at the end of this. But when we get back, let's talk about your latest projects. I mean, again, I recognized you from Baywatch, but I read your resume, and it's impressive, and it's still very impressive. Maybe I am going to definitely have to tune in specifically to Spike TV and watch you and say, oh, okay, that's who it is. And
on my website. My website has all the show, like, because they're 10 minutes or half hour shows where we go to the sets of big movies, and I'm the on-camera guy. So we went all the way to Thailand to do The Hangover Part 2, or we go down to Brazil. We did the Fast Five down there. And so I interview all the actors, directors, stunt guys, and I get to play with the cars and the guns, and it's the coolest job. And so if you go to www.davidchokichi.com, And you go over hoisting rails, you can see me interviewing Stallone and all these guys.
Oh, wow.
And Diesel. Yeah, and all the boys. And Bradley Cooper from, like, we did the A-Team. And also The Hangover. And so it goes on and on. It's kind of cool. So people, it's definitely something to check out.
Absolutely, Dave. When we get back, and I'll want to, I wish I could have some of those people on my radio show. We'll see if that somehow you ever can help me out with a few of them. So when we get back.
Yeah,
more,
you got it, man.
Oh, thanks, man. When we get back, more with David Chokichi, and we're going to really go into specifically enough his projects and stuff, life after Baywatch and everything. You're listening to Total Education Celebrity Show, powered by the Beach Lifestyle Celebrity Segment. We'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Education Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. You got to go on Twitter at TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook. And, David, I've been pretty frustrated with West Penn AAA or AAA Motor Car Services. They really have dropped the ball on me three times, so I had to mention that for a bit so that all the people listening can hear that, because that's my beef right now. And if you're on Facebook, you check that out, and also Twitter. Let's go next. David, into specifically the current projects that are going on in life after Baywatch, because once Baywatch was over, was it difficult to become a working actor and keep working all the time, or you just basically just pumped through it and said, I'm going to keep persevering?
You know, there was a lot of after Baywatch and during, you know, there was a lot of judgment, ill or criticism of us as actors, basically saying that none of us could act. And it was back in the day when no film actors did TV, and you know, and we really got a bad rap, man, because you know, Baywatch was it's a medium of entertainment. You know, we never claimed to be doing Shakespeare in the Park. You know what I mean? And there have been some phenomenal actors that have come through there and gone through there. I mean, Alexander Paul is fantastic, you know. Jason Simmons, Yasmin, you know, and the list goes on and on. Parker Stevenson, he came on for a while, and he is a really talented actor, and he also loves to direct, so that was his trade-off. You know, and Hasselhoff is good. You know, he's good. We're running around in shorts and speedos and this girl and with, you know, boobs and whatever. So they automatically they throw us under a bus and they assume you can't act. So after Baywatch ended and I tried to, you know, you have to go audition and get in casting rooms. A lot of people were either would just say flat out, no, he was on Baywatch, he can't act, and have never looked at your demo reel.
Oh, my gosh.
You'd go in the room, and they would look at you and, you know, be hypercritical of your performance. They would never give you a break. I stuck with it, man. I fought it and bought it and, you know. And you just get a thick skin, and I've gone on to persevere, and I've done that, you know. After that, I did a pilot for Jon Favreau that was just amazing. Vince Vaughn was in, and then, you know, it was just at the wrong network. It was at UPN when UPN was around,
yeah.
And it didn't get picked up. But soon after that, I got Witchblade, which was one of the best written shows that I've ever been on, which was a critically acclaimed hit TV series for TNT that we did for years. That was based on a comic book and just was so ahead of its time and unreal. And when that ended, you know, and in between, I've done like tons of movies for like Sci-Fi Channel. I've had a movie go to, I did a movie called Psycho Beach Party that made it into the Sundance Film Festival. I worked for Sci-Fi Channel a lot, or Lifetime, or Hallmark, or, you know, I had a role in Soul Surfer, the Bethany Hamilton movie where she lost her arm. You know, this year's been a boom. I've done like four or five movies since November last year. Yeah. And it's really cool. I have like a fantastic one coming up called Army of the Damned, where I get to play this just total prick of a cop. And basically, it's a reality show is following around these cops in this really small, sleepy town, and we respond to a domestic dispute, and the family's been slaughtered, and it turns out the house is basically demonized, and there's zombies, and things just go off the rails. And the lead singer from Godsmack, Sully Erner, he played the lead, and we have a fantastic cast, Tommy Dreamer, all these horror movie actors that Michael Barrymore, who am I forgetting? Just horror genre guys that have been doing it forever. And the final product is unreal. Joey Fatone from NSYNC, he is in it.
Oh, wow.
He is hilarious. So that's coming out. And I actually shot a movie over in Bulgaria in May. And that was actually a horror story called Roseville, based on a true story. And it's a cold case that took place during the 80s. And I play an ex-CIA agent who befriends the KGB agent. And we're both pining for the same woman. And we both kind of have this cabin, bed and breakfast, that we kind of retreat to that no one knows about. And it's kind of a cover, you know, honeymooners come, and but it's a place for us to kind of like disappear, because I've become kind of a mole. And it was unbelievably shot, and it guarantee it is going to freak the crap out of people. Both of these horror movies are.
Wow.
That's coming out. And then I just did a short. I have a really small role in this movie called this short film called Alone Time, that Josh Murphy produced. And you'll see a bunch of it. It'll be on Twitter and my Facebook page. And you should check it out. It's 12 minutes, and it's based on a true story. And Rose Hemingway plays the lead. And there's very little dialogue. It's been, you'll see it. Once you watch it, you'll get it. And when the ending will freak you out like you never freaked out. And it's not a gory thing or anything. But you'll never see it coming. And it's based on a true story, like I said. So definitely check that out. You can actually go online right now and see it. And it's called Alone Time on Vimeo or YouTube or and I'll post it on my website too. So
fantastic, David. Yeah. I mean, you have a lot. You're one of the hardest working actors, and honestly, and I'm being honest, didn't know what was going on with your career, and that's what happens a lot of times. You get one role that defines you, yet you do all this work, and because you are not, you know, it's not the biggest blockbuster, you play a role in the movie but not something that is like the lead in certain aspects that never makes tons of money, you are successful because you're a working actor that continues to work. And it's not the easiest thing in the world to keep working, is it? It's
no, man, it's brutal. I mean, and, you know, the writer's strike definitely killed a lot. That was the hardest time for me and everybody. You know, it destroyed families. I mean, I couldn't imagine being, like, you know, being in a relationship with, like, if it was my wife, if she was a writer and I was an actor. Like, I mean, it was like a year and a half with this huge hangover of no work. It took like a year for work to... Once the strike ended, it took at least a year for work to like pick up, and people got crushed, you know. And so I survived that, and just kind of persevered. And like I said, I've gone on also to like trying and hosting and doing this show called Action with Spike TV and Comedy Central. That's also filled in like a lot of voids in between movies, or you know, whenever every time. And those are fantastic jobs.
How'd you get that gig? How'd you get that gig? Because that seems really amazing to get to meet all these cool people.
Yeah, I did this really kind of cheesy reality TV show called Confessions of a Teen Idol. Scott Baio talked me into it. And so I said no. They offered me some money. And then basically I told my agent, I go, tell them we want this ridiculous number. And... And my agent's like, you'll never get paid that, David. And then I go, great. I don't have a decision to make. And sure enough, a day later, VH1 came back for the money. And I was like, well, looks like I'm doing the show. But so I did the show. And actually, someone with this guy from Spike, this Eric Bloom, who's an executive over at Viacom, was watching. And he's like, this is the kind of guy I've been looking for to host the show. He's kind of surviving a lot of tough situations. He's good on camera, blah, blah, blah. He's athletic, charismatic, blah, blah. And so basically we had a phone meeting, and next thing I knew I was on a plane. We went over to Wales to do Clash of the Titans, and I interview all, like, Sam Worthington and Gemma Arterton and all the boys, you know, everybody in the movie. And then, you know, I also get to, it's a great interview because it's not, we don't care about your method of acting. Like, we want to know what these guys did last night, or I get to play with the stunt guys and shoot all the guns, or, you know what I mean? Or mess around with the actors, have them show me some stunts, or, you know, it's very playful and very anti-interview, which as an actor myself, I love, because you're so sick of hearing, like, what is your method, or how, where did you study, you know? Like,
exactly. You like a conversation like you and I are having right now, just having a beer and just learning about each other. That's cool.
Yeah, exactly.
Which I've not told you my background, David, a former professional wrestler, school teacher, now own a tutoring consulting company, entrepreneur, but yet looking to write books. So I have an interesting life, how I've kind of developed this, and I just love interviewing people like you. And now I'm going to say, holy cow, what an interesting thing. Everyone needs to check out Spike TV for sure to see all those awesome people you're interviewing. And you keep working hard as a working actor, because I have a good friend named Scott Levy who does video game acting, but he stays working. And he tells me flat out, man, it is such a challenge, and that there's so many people.
Yeah.
This is an art. This is what people don't understand. Yeah. They think that you guys make millions and millions of dollars, and there's only a few that do. But you guys have a passion for this. This is just what you love, isn't it?
Exactly. Exactly. You know, and I'm a big believer in work begets work, man. I mean, you know, that's why in this short I did with Rose Hemingway, you know, it's kind of the idea is you see me, I'm in focus, and then I'm kind of out of focus, and then I come back into focus. It's very short, but that's kind of the effect, and you'll see why when you watch it. Like I said, it takes 12 minutes. But, you know, through that, I've met this, you know, I was doing, I do a lot of PSAs for California State Parks, and one of the directors, the director of the Cal State Parks PSA I did was producing this short and asked me to be in it. And, you know, these guys are going to go on to make incredible movies. It's a young group of very talented writers and actors and directors that they're all kind of connected with, and you know, so you know, I kind of do him a favor and I did a small role, and you know, we hope to like do, you know, like many movies together. And there's always, you know, it's like you meet new people, or you find someone and they like your work, or someone sees you in this and they're like, you know, it just kind of, it radiates and snowballs from there.
Absolutely.
You know, and
most definitely, David. So two things, I guess you have a lot of websites to promote now, and let's give you them. First of all, some of the foundation work you're doing, and then also some websites on yourself and I guess information on some of your other things you're promoting. So go down the list and see what you can promote in the next. A lot of it's at your a lot of it's your website, right?
Yeah. If you go on my website, a lot of the charitable work is all on there. You know, primarily, like I said, Surf Rider Foundation and Heal the Bay and Waterkeeper Alliance, Sea Paddle, which is Surfers Environmental Alliance, Best Friends Animal Society.
Wow, you have a lot.
Yeah.
And then you have all those other promotions. But if you go to your website or Twitter, The Real David Chokichi, they can check out a lot of the stuff. Your Facebook page, tell us about that, and the website, and find out all the cool things you're doing. They got to stay on that website for a while. You're doing so many interesting things.
Yeah, and there's a lot of cool, you know, I put a lot of videos from, you know, my demo reels on there. I have an action reel. And then I have a lot of different, like I just did this show called Miss You Much with Kathy Brightman, which was, I don't know if you've seen that yet, it's on VH1. And it was funny as hell. I took her out. I tried to teach her how to stand up paddle. And sure enough, like I'm a really good stand up paddler, but I was the first one to fall in the ocean. It was on camera. She's like, she fell in first. Yeah, you know, definitely go to www.davidjokichi.com, and there's a lot of information on there. And then Twitter, definitely. I think the handle is The Real David Chokichi or The Real Chokichi. And then Facebook is the same, I believe. If you type in David Chokichi, although I've seen like another one on there sort of this morning, which is kind of disturbing. but basically, you'll know it's me because there's me. I'm surfing on a wave, like in the background, and you should be able to get the drift. Like that, it's actually like really that's my website.
Awesome.
And yeah,
cool.
So that's it, man.
Well, David, thanks for calling. We got to bring you back in the next quarter, meaning the next 3 months, and then you could give us an update on how all these other projects have gone. And I enjoyed talking to you, so thanks for calling.
Yeah, you bet. And there's two movies out right now. It's called one called Jetstream and one called Collision Course that I did with Tia Carrera that are on like Sci-Fi or on you can get them on iTunes. That are both kind of very cool, fun movies that people would dig.
Awesome. Well, thanks for calling, man.
Yep.
Take care.
All right, brother. Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
Appreciate You're welcome.
It.
Okay. See ya. Bye bye. You're listening to Toll Education Celebrity Show on the Toll Education Network, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Toll Education Celebrity Show on the Toll Education Network, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, and it's the Beach Lifestyle Celebrity segment. And I'm really excited to welcome the program from MTV's Beach House and the Real World 20, Karan Dunbar, and much, much more. You're the jack of all trades. Karan, thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Well, absolutely. Excited to talk to you. And I want to learn about you. And the situation is when I get these actors that have been successful or entertainers have been successful, we really want to go back to their childhood. I guess that's the education teacher in me to say, what drives you? What led you to where you are today? Was it kind of strange, the path you took? I can tell you my path is a very strange one as well. So, Karan, let's go right specifically to your childhood. Tell us about growing up. Were you always interested in being an entertainer?
It's really interesting you say about the path. I think the path that we take as artists and entertainers is the path that a lot of people feel is not a successful path. Your parents feel, I think it's usually out of caring. Spike Lee made a very good point. He said the number one dream killers in the world are parents. Because, and they do it out of love. And it's the truth. Like, parents will tell you, oh, don't be an actor, don't go into music. That they do it out of love because they want you to be successful. So at a young age, I grew up in Hartford, Connecticut. That's actually where I was born at. And when I've lived there, you know, I kind of lived in a rough area. So that was kind of like one of those things that you really, you know, being a comedian, being an actor, that was just stuff that people didn't normally do. And I've always just had a passion for acting. It's just something I've always wanted to do. I'd always watch. Like, I was raised by my grandparents, and before I moved there, I was always just a fan of it. And it was just a way to express myself. I was always doing these little skits. Every person has their story, but I was doing little skits and things like that. And it's one of the things that I don't think you can ever explain. It's just either it's something that you can't go a day without thinking about. Ever since I was a child, I was always performing. I was always on stage, via just in a classroom or at film reunions and so forth. After my mother passed away, I relocated to Agawam, Massachusetts, in Springfield, in that area. And I relocated to Pennsylvania, which I went from literally like the city to like the rural, you know, black and white cows, the countryside of America. And with my grandfather, it's kind of a military environment. So, you know, any talk of actually being a comedian was just, you know, kind of taboo in the family. But my grandmother, you know, my grandfather's your typical townie from Manchester, New Hampshire, the Boston area up there. And my grandmother's from the South. She always was one that was pretty much fueled that flame. Like, when my grandfather wasn't around, she'd have me, like, learn to play the organ. She'd always talk to me about, like, acting and this and that. And I remember my first – it sounds so cheesy, but my first role I ever had was actually this little skit that we had in school. And it was, like, a little play. And I went on stage, and my grandmother was, like, so proud. And everyone was like, wow, the kid, you know, he – I could memorize lines. I think that's why they're impressed. I could memorize lines. I could speak loud. That's what it took to impress parents. But after that, I got that taste of it. And I pretty much started I was always getting in trouble in school, but I was joked around a lot. So it wasn't like you're smoking in a bathroom trouble. It was always just like, I was always like class clown, joked around, made teachers laugh, and just always had a sense of humor. But certain teachers said they liked me in their class because they said it made it more enjoyable. So I would, like, they'd say something about history, and I would just make a joke about what we were learning. We could be learning about Native Americans, this and that. And I'd always have this, like, you know, this sense of humor that would just carry on and carry on and so forth. And in high school, at that point, that's where, you know, your guidance counselors, I remember telling a teacher, every interview I do, every newspaper, magazine, I always bring this up. I remember one of my teachers, you know, I would tell, you know, them I want to be a comedian or an actor when I grow up. And they would always tell you that same line you've always heard before. There's 10,000 starving actors out there. What makes you think you're not going to be that starving actor? I'm like, yeah, but there's also 10,000 other actors out there that are working, and it depends. And he was like, well, you know, you're going to be on the corner probably smoking cigarettes, you know, living a dead-end life. And this is teachers. These are high school. Granted, you know, yeah. I'm a little bit older, so this is what teachers were saying back then. And it was perfectly fine and normal. And I remember him telling me, just get a job. I believe telling me, just get a job and hold on to that job, and your success will be maintaining a job. So I was always – I played sports all my life, and that's one thing that kind of kept me being, like, just, you know, not giving up and pushing forward. And I remember taking television productions class with Mr. Shuey, and that was, like, one teacher that actually, I think, kind of got me, and he kind of understood where I was coming from. And I loved the class. I excelled in it. I learned about editing. I learned about production. I've learned about all that stuff, and it was fascinating. And I was actually the lead host and writer. So I watched a lot of, like, MTV, like Jon Stewart show, which was before what he does now, and I just was just fascinated by it. So I kind of, like, would borrow from that, and I would write these skits. I'd come to class, like, early, which kids never do, and I'd write these skits. I'd perform it. We tell the news and that we had with the school. And at that point, oddly enough, I got kicked out of school, and I talked my way into getting an internship at a local radio station, television station, NBC 25. And again, now here you are, this kid that's kind of, like, you know, not really being accepted for what he, you know, his goals, his dreams and desires, what he wants to do, and you land an internship in high school, which usually a lot of the kids that were, like, the outstanding class students were the ones that got these jobs. So I ended up getting that job, learned a lot about it, and from that point, I just started, like, realizing that you've got to kind of grab the bull by the horns and pretty much go after it. And, you know, I was that weird kid that always said yes to the wrong ideas. So they're like, you know, you can't just go up to Conan O'Brien and tell him you want to be on the show. You can't just call him. And I'm like, well, why not? You know, there's an email address here. Hey, there's a number here, too. And this is before Google. I was one of those kids that were using Google before it got really popular on the internet. So I was, like, Googling Mike Sweeney, which is the head writer for Conan O'Brien at the time, when Conan O'Brien, I'm emailing this guy. I'm calling him asking, hey, I've got this comedy skit idea. He actually liked it. Well, then next thing you know, I'm on, you know, Conan O'Brien doing a skit that you know, Hans Schaller and I wrote. And it's just, like I said, saying yes to the wrong ideas. And pretty much that was my childhood. Just pretty much trying to put it all together and piece together. Because, you know, you live in Pennsylvania. It's not L.A. or it's not New York.
No, exactly. So, you gotta take the chances, Karan. And that's what you did. And ultimately, I look at myself right now in my life. I'm 40 years old, former professional wrestler, school teacher, own a tutoring consulting company, but I have the entertainment bug again. I love doing this radio thing. I get to interview people from all different facets of life, and it's my passion. I stay up late at night to interview people all the time too, Karan. So more about, you know, doing the celebrity deal. We'll do an interview now most of my work day, but at night I'm putting the work and everything. So what I'm hearing from you specifically is, hey, you got kicked out of school. Boom, you jumped in. You got it. And right place, right time, you end up on the radio. Then you say, hey, I want more. I want to do more.
Yes.
So then when you said, hey, I want to do more, I'm going to go ahead and do this. And this is what fuels me every day. Okay, what celebrities are going to have on this week? I want A-list celebrities. How am I going to go out doing this? I'm not going to hear a no for an answer. Okay, I made a connection with the NFL. Fantastic. Made a connection with great authors. Okay, let's work on other people. And it's a constant drive. And that's what you had.
Yeah.
And so when you went on, got the opportunity, Conan O'Brien, tell us what happened there.
Okay, so you've hit it right on the head. That's exactly what it boils down to. I kind of grew up in that environment at military, and that's one thing I pride myself on. When I go to L.A. for film screenings, when I go to New York, I'm proud to say I'm from Pennsylvania, because there's something about the PA culture,
yes, yeah.
And I always call it that blue-collar grind, where we don't care where you're from, we don't care what people say about us, we're going to go ahead, and our work ethic is unlike no other. I don't know what it is, but that's what I've always been credited for. And you hit it on the head when you said it's just you have to have that attitude that, okay, well, I understand that this needs to be done. For this to be this, you've got to do this, you've got to do that to be an agent, you've got to do this, do that. But I did a lot of stuff that, you know, the excuses that people make for not asking, like, well, I don't want to ask this person, I want someone to ask me. 95% of the work I've gotten is by referrals, wow, or by asking. See? And that's what it boils down to. And same with Conan. Like, my mentor, he's actually from Pittsburgh, just pretty much like I call my big brother, Hans Schaller. He was one of those guys that really made things happen. We work well together. And I came up with the idea and the concept, and we pretty much wrote it together. And I was a big fan of Conan O'Brien when he was in New York. And we decided to do the skit on Joel Goddard, which is kind of like the quirky announcer, and him having his fan club. The whole concept revolved around him having his fan club, which he's kind of like not even an important figure on the show. He was just did the announcements, and they'd have skits upon him every month or so about it. So we thought it'd be hysterical to have this really quirky group of people that are just completely obsessed with Conan, with Joel Goddard. So Mike Sweeney, we sent him the idea for it. And he was just like, well, first of all, how did you get my information? So I told him, and he was like, well, go ahead. You got me on the phone, talk to me. I explained it to him. And he was like, I tell you what, he's cracking up laughing. He was like, you know, Joel has a fan club. I'm like, yes. They're based out of South Central PA. I was like, we did have 4 members. Now we're down to 3, but we're making a comeback. And he got the sense of humor that I was using. So he's like, I'll tell you what, you get up here, there's a chance we'll go ahead and put you on the show. So I'm like, all right, fine. So at that point, any other person probably would have been like, okay, that would have been a story to tell over a beer with their friends. Friends will think they're cool. Like, no, I took this one next step further. I talked to Hans Schaller. Hans and I went up there. We actually made shirts. We love Joel Goddard. And my girlfriend, Hans, and I went up there, and we're waiting in line to actually because we got tickets to the show, waiting in line to actually just watch the show. Well, people are cracking up laughing because these are huge Conan fans.
Right.
And they get the humor. They're cracking up laughing. So this guy in security comes down, and he's like, hey, I need to talk to you guys. We're like, this is either really, really good or really, really bad. So they basically seat us right in front, like, where Conan performs. And we're sitting there, and, you know, Conan comes out on stage, he talks to people. Before the show, he always comes out and talks to people and says, hey, how are you guys doing? They have a comedian that comes out. That's actually the job that I had at MTV, where you kind of warm the crowd up, you talk to them, and then they bring out the main guest. So he comes out. That was like, enough of this, Conan. Where's Joel Goddard at? So Conan looks at me, he walks over, and he reads the shirt, and he's like, are you guys serious? He's cracking up laughing. The audience is laughing, and he can't stop laughing. So he cracks a few jokes about it. Everyone around me is like, man, you know, they're like, what's going on here? Conan starts his show, and he's like, I got to mention this before we go any further. Apparently, they're part of the Joel Goddard fan club, and the actual skit that we sent up there, Conan used and added 2 more jokes in there. And boom, next thing you know, we're like in front of millions of people. People are getting the jokes. There's actually a fan club that came out because of it, of complete like cult followers of Conan O'Brien. At the time, I was doing stand-up comedy, so that right there raised my stock to the roof. Now you've got a credit of doing Conan O'Brien, MTV Beach House, and I'll be honest with you, it was all blue-collar grinding. I wish I could tell you a story that's, you know, where I did it the legit way, and I did this, I did that, but it was just putting yourself out there.
It seems like
and
it.
Absolutely,
Karan, and I want to go into that before we go into your passion again, which is Greencastle and being involved and being the creative mind, because I could see that blue-collar attitude. I love when you bring that up about Pennsylvania people. I mean, honestly, people say to me, how many hours a day do you work as an entrepreneur? Well, I run 3 businesses pretty much, Total Education Network, Total Tutor, and Beach Lifestyle. So I really have a huge amount of time, but I love everything I do. do, but I always want to step the bar up. And that's what, Karan, I see. I have a feeling I'll be hearing from you in 5 years, and you'll be like, hey, Neil, I just hanging out here or something. I'll say, that's it, because I see your passion, and I want to learn more about it. So we're gonna, when we get back, we're going to go more into MTV, then Green Castle, and then anything else you're trying to promote. And you're one person that's a talker. Two segments is not enough for you, Karan. You're going to have to come back in a couple months to update us on everything, because it's a lot of fun having a conversation with you. You're listening to Toll Education Celebrity Show on the Toll Education Network, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to Toll Education Celebrity Show on the Toll Education Network, powered by the Beach Lifestyle Celebrity segment. And I'm with Karan Dunbar, MTV, Beach House, Real World, all these different things. And we got to find out why. And I guess Conan O'Brien with the big break. So basically, people started saying, you're the man, and it rose your stock tremendously. How did you get to MTV now? Did you just make phone calls? Is it teaching us that, guess what? If you make phone calls and email and just keep bugging the producer, something's going to happen for you?
Yeah, this is a little different. It goes back to what I said earlier. 95% of the work I get is either by asking or by referral or someone else. My big thing was stand-up comedy. That is the reason why I'm here. That's the reason why I always have to give respect to my first passion, which was comedy. You know, my goal was to get into acting, get into filmmaking. But comedy just seemed like a viable way. Hey, you know, I'm kind of a funny guy. You can go on stage, you can tell jokes, and go from there. So comedy was kind of one of the things that we're kind of like the redheaded stepchildren of the entertainment business. There's really no union for us. There's really no, like, you know, actors have SAG, they have AFTRA, they have all, and they can go into commercials, this and that. Comedy, you know, one of my mentors, again, Hans Schaller, said something when we were talking about comedy. If you're not funny, you starve. And if you're not funny and you're not good with people, you're not going to be successful in it, and be it on stage or be it in art or in life. So a friend of mine, she invited me to come up there because really attractive girl. She decided to have me come up there, and at that point, I'm like, yeah, I'll tag along and go up there. And where I'm from, again, where I live at now, it's it's not normal to hear people like Glenda Yarbrough and myself doing things like that. So she said, hey, I'm going to New York. She knew I knew my way around there. Can you go up there? So I'm like, sure, why not? And I ended up tagging along with her, went up there, and next thing I know, we're staying in, I remember a TV show, it was called Say What Karaoke, and one of her contacts through a network said, hey, I work at MTV, I can have you come up here, so on and so on, and she invited me to tag along, so I tagged along up there. Next thing you know, they have a person by the name of Rhett Michaels, which is a comedian. I think he's still doing comedy up in New York. He actually allowed me to go on stage. I'm like, hey, do you mind if I get some time to tell some jokes on stage? So he was like, you know, why not? So, I think I was a lot more bored than I was then than I am now. And I go on stage, just start telling some jokes. People are laughing, this and that. There were some people out in the crowd that actually were good to network with. So I ended up... Glenda ended up actually getting a bigger role is working on the MTV Awards alongside rapper 50 Cent. So she pretty much was on her way, and I'm still kind of like trying to figure out where I fit in. Well, needless to say, I end up working, you know, at the beach house up there just by doing just freelance, just same thing I did when I worked at NBC. By circumstances, again, this is never ever a good story, I was like looking, okay, I'm going to move up to Long Island. But due to circumstances, which led me to be a single father, I ended up moving back to Greencastle to raise my son. So at that point, that was kind of like a downfall. I felt it as you know, I'm happy that I took care of my son because of the circumstances. But you know, it was kind of a roadblock that just motivated me even more. And what that MTV title with Conan O'Brien, I just started pretty much learning the business. I didn't realize I had it's show business for a reason. 10% is show, 90% of it's the business part. You have to understand how to interact with people, how to deal with people, being on time, being a person of your word, things like that. So, I ended up pretty much backing off of whole comedy, all that stuff, and like, okay, it's time for me to grow up, me. And I ended up getting, you know, the corporate job. So I started having these cool corporate perks, insurance, you know, money in your checking and savings account, being able to do the things that, you know, starving artists can't do. And I thought I was happy, but I started realizing that, you know, I wasn't content. I wasn't really, I was still doing comedy shows here and there and traveling, but it wasn't the same. It wasn't where I was submerged in it. So I ended up deciding I want to make a film. You know, I want to create the film, which is Green Castle. And when I told people around here about that, everyone thought I was crazy. Everyone was like, this guy's nuts, you know. Oh, Karan, the class clown from, oh, no, and it's not going to happen. And that just fueled me. I was like, you know what, I'm going to create a film. And I've had enough contacts, I've worked with enough people, I think I can do this. So I ended up going back to my old stand by Hans Schaller, which was the only person actually kind of like in the beginning stages really believed in it. I didn't need to learn how to write a screenplay, didn't learn how to do that. So I actually had to learn to do that. Hans really motivated me to kind of get to that next level. And we just took it step by step by step by step. Dave Vanderveer, which is like a keystone of like the production company that we run now, he got involved in it, and just a lot of the right people got involved in it. And I wrote it. We cast people, Dua Mua, the actor from Gran Torino, which was a huge, again, networking. I had in the past had dated his cousin, and I sent him the script. I was figuring he's going to say no. I'm like, this guy's just done, you know, a huge successful film. Why is he going to want to do my independent film? He Facebooks me back. Hey, I'm on board. You know, here's what, you know, I charge. If you can cover it, I'm on the team. And we were able to cover it, and we just kept grinding on this film, just trying to, like, you know, put it a short abridged version of it. But we put it together. And the thing about what we did in this area is we made a lot of people realize you can't use the excuse, you know, oh, well, you've got to move to New York, you've got to move to L.A. to do stuff. That's just an excuse. And there's a quote that Hans always taught me. If you can't do it here, you can't do it anywhere. And a lot of people feel that you've got to move to New York. If you can't do it in your own old hometown, you're not going to be able to do it in New York or L.A. You've got to start somewhere. You've got to basically just pretty much push forward. And we made this film. You know, I started it, I wrote it, I directed it. And it started to get really viral because I was just always networking and talking to people and meeting people. But the difference between myself and a lot of other filmmakers and a lot of other people is we actually had something. There was a track record. Like, okay, the internet doesn't lie. You know, if you say you're doing something, you're doing this, if I type your name and if I say I'm a karate master and you Google Karan Dunmore karate master and it doesn't show up, well, guess what? Okay, there's some explaining to do. But people start, like, doing research on it. Social networking has brought, you know, us independent filmmakers and actors leaps and bounds.
It truly has. It's amazing. One award-winning film, and you're getting tons of work. That's all it is. That's all you need is that. And I had Pamela. It was Pamela Stanley. It's Pamela. I had her on my show. She was married to one of the Kiss stars, and Pamela Bowen, that was not on for so many years, is an actress. And then she had one successful deal producing, and now she got a big role. So basically, independent film is kind of like the lifeline for people to get discovered in certain ways.
Yes. Yes. You're absolutely right. And what it's done is it's allowed you to communicate to people you never would have talked to and deal with a lot of people you never talked to. And you know, fellow filmmaker Trina Yachefu, who's a filmmaker who's done the film Alaska Land, she really put us on with a really good sound guy, which is, you know, that's one thing about the film. Like, when you deal with independent film, you and I both know this, and I know you as a host get this, where you're like, oh, independent film. Okay, and you're thinking grainy video, really bad audio, horrible acting, horrible trailer, and they shot it on their dad's camcorder in the basement. And that's the reality how a lot of indie films used to be and still are, but with technology, it's got a lot cheaper. People are shooting on DSLR cameras now, and it's became a lot more affordable now, where you can shoot quote-unquote films that look like real films. On, you know, you don't have to shoot on film anymore. Film is extremely expensive, and shooting everything digital has made people like myself, where you get the word no a lot. You know, why does Karan make his own film? Why does any other actor or filmmaker make your film? You know you're talented, but you don't get that opportunity yet. And that's what I did. I gave myself a platform to say, okay, hey, this is what I can do. And it's one thing to screen a film in my hometown. You know, we sold out the Maryland Theater, which was great. It was great. I mean, it was a huge theater, 1,500 people, sold out 6 weeks in advance, which was a great feeling. But me, as you know, being competitive, being the athlete, you know, I grew up, you know, living that lifestyle. I want to challenge myself, and I want to hear the word no. I want to hear the word yes. I want to know that this film is not a great film, but a good first film. And we went to Idlewild Film Festival, and that was probably such one of the, you know, greatest moments of my life, going out to a festival where they don't want to like you. They don't know who you are. You're just another filmmaker. But when you win an award and people are watching your films and other filmmakers are saying, wow, this is your first film, they're not telling you it's a great film. They're saying, wow, this is your first film. And I'm modest. I'm like, yeah. And where are you from? Pennsylvania. And you know, if they ask you, are you from Philadelphia or Pittsburgh? I'm like, no. And like, there's film out there? I'm like, yeah, we, you know, there's film out there. And now it, what it does is it allows you to connect with other people. And I've met amazing people, some of the actors that I've worked with, where we're going to be friends, lifelong friends. And that's what, you know, what Greencastle did. It allowed me, I wouldn't be talking to you here. I would just be another right. guy that, yeah, Benny O'Brien years ago at MTV. What are you doing now? I mean, my, you know, boxing trainer always told me, you know, you're only as good as you are today.
Exactly. That's so true. I got one question, and Zuri, we didn't really get into the film. We learned about Karan Dunbar, and people got to go and purchase the film to find out. But the story, pretty much, if I'm correct on this, from just, again, getting to know you and different things, is naming it after the town pretty much shows your life in certain ways, right? The Greencastle.
You're absolutely
event.
Right. Right. You're absolutely right. Yeah, yeah. The film primarily was just, it was a film about, I wanted to make it universal. I didn't want to be that, the hipster filmmaker, which, you know, again, Greencastle has allowed me to do college lectures and talk to, like, other aspiring filmmakers and people and explain to them, like, I went out there, and I call it blue-collar filmmaking. I went out there with the mentality where I want to make a universal film that everyone can relate to somewhat or another. And it, the film is primarily about, you know, hope and regret. You know, you have two things can happen in life. You have hope and you have regret. And it just kind of like perils my life living in Pennsylvania and a lot of the hardships, you know, I dealt with. Granted, a lot of the film, because there's, you know, there's a big twist in it, but it's a lot of film is relative, but a lot of it's symbolic to the trials and errors of life. And that's what I wanted to do, and that's all I wanted. My goal was, I didn't know I was going to, you know, win multiple awards. I didn't know I was going to win, you know, a Best Director, Best Actor
right.
award.
Exactly.
I went out there, and I set the bar really low. And I always tell people that. Set the bar really low and under-promise and over-deliver. And that goes a long way. Don't tell everyone you're going to have all this great stuff because people set the bar higher. And if you don't reach that bar or you come close to it, then they're a little disappointed. And I just pretty much said, I want to go out there and inspire one person. Well, you know, 2,000 DVD sales later, over 100,000 views on YouTube of the trailer later, multiple film festivals later, I still get emails from people saying, you know, I watched your film and it inspired me. And I read every email, like even the bad ones, the people that can't hate my guts and they hate the film and this and that. I read every email because at the end of the day, my goal is to basically inspire and just motivate
That's
people
fantastic.
To go out there and
Fantastic, Karan. And one other question. What's new with you now? You know, Greencastle is still promoting the film, which is absolutely, again, with the award that you won, what an awesome, unbelievable break and getting you into a new craft. What are you looking to do now? What's new at Karan Dunbar?
We're going to, honestly, we're backing up a little bit, and we're in the midst of pre-production on the new film, The Ephesian. This film's a short film. We're working with a writer out of Ohio, Mark Lyons. And I want to back things up a little bit and really, as a filmmaker myself, diversify my talents. This time I want to say, okay, you know what? I did a film. I wore the hat of like five different people. Because, you know, when you're shooting on a budget, you know,
yeah, exactly.
you know, right below 100,000, there's really not a lot you can do. There's really not much you can do, believe it or not. So I said, let's back up. Let's do a short film. Let's learn the craft, and that's the thing with filmmaking. You want to learn the craft. I'm still a student. You know, I get uncomfortable with the term filmmaker. It's okay when other people call me filmmaker, but to introduce myself as a filmmaker, it's still awkward. I'm still in that awkward phase. So we're doing The Ephesian. We have a really good cast. It's actually a union film. It's a Screen Actors Guild film. So that's exciting. So that's pretty much what we're doing now. We go into production in November, and Just really excited to see what our company is going to present for people to see and kind of see another side of what we can do.
Well, are you looking to do acting as well while you're doing all this? Are you?
I've been steady auditioning. I've been auditioning for the past. I just had a spot on House of Cards. That's a new film, a new actually series on Netflix original, which if you get the chance, it's an amazing series. Kevin Spacey's in it, really good series. It's called House of Cards. And pretty much just auditioning, have had some commercial work. So I'm doing what you're supposed to do, pretty much hearing the word no a lot, and hearing the word out of every 20 no's you hear, one yes. And that's the life of an artist, just hearing a lot of no's and maybe a few yeses.